Switching topics now, how the Keystone fight was won. President Obama recently decided to reject the Keystone XL pipeline proposal, and it is the culmination of a very, very successful grassroots activist campaign, and it really persuaded the Obama administration, who initially, you can hear him on tape saying this, was in favor of this project. It encouraged him and persuaded him to change his course against building this, what has been described as a major piece of fossil fuel infrastructure. The grassroots campaign has been going on for some years, and we're delighted to have two people with us who are involved in the campaign this half hour of the show. Jamie Henn is co-founder and strategy and communications director for 350.org, which is an international climate change organization campaign. It has helped organize over 20,000 climate demonstrations in 190 countries, lead the fight against the Keystone XL pipeline, coordinate with the People's Climate March. As director, he plays a key role in creating the strategy for the organization and coordinating political advocacy. Jamie, thank you very much for being with us this part of the show. Hi.
Well, it's very good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Dallas Goldtooth is also here. Dallas is the Keystone XL campaign organizer for the Indigenous Environmental Network. He co-founded the comedy group, the 1491s, and he's a Dakota culture and language teacher. He's also a poet, a traditional artist, a powwow MC, a comedian, and a father. Dallas, thank you very much for being with us.
Happy to be on the show. Thank you very much.
Yeah, our pleasure to have you here. So when did it all start? Was it, I have read that certainly Native groups in Canada had very early concerns about this, and you may, Dallas, have been among the first voices to later achieve prominence saying there's a problem here.
Yeah, this issue actually, the fight against Keystone XL goes way back and actually goes to the source, the tar sands up in northern Alberta.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 2007 and 2008, our organization, the Indigenous Environmental Network, was approached by some families that were based in northern Alberta that were concerned and wanted to raise awareness about this developing economy around tar sands extraction and had serious concerns about it. And so we were, you know, up until then, not many people knew about tar sands. Even up until the KXL fight, not many people here in the United States knew about tar sands. And so the indigenous struggle to protect lands from this dirty oil extraction really begins at the source of northern Alberta. When TransCanada proposed the Keystone One and the Keystone One pipeline, there was resistance from the tribes back then. And with KXL, way back in 2010, you know, so the tribes were definitely engaged in the process of informing our frontline communities, the tribal nations, not only about the dangers the proposed route would have on their lands, but then also connecting them to the source. You're really showing that this pipeline also impacts our indigenous relatives up north in northern Alberta.
So to whom?
So the path has been a long time coming.
To whom did you make your grievances known?
It was something special, and I think one of what made this interesting fight is that it was because the pipeline was going to cross the United States-Canadian border. It really came down to they needed a presidential permit. They needed the president to sign off on it.
Mm-hmm.
And in order for him to make his decision, he had to get input from different agencies, but the key one was the State Department. So, you know, tribes have a special nation-to-nation relationship with the federal government. And so we had a special and a certain amount of access to other NGO, non-government organizations and nonprofits didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
So our grievances went to the State Department as well as the Secretary of Interior, who is the designated person to work with tribes from the federal government side. And, of course, President Obama himself.
Mm-hmm. Jamie Henn, how did you get President Obama to change his mind?
Well, it was a long fight and many years of work. And again, you know, 350 got involved in this fight against Keystone XL really late. As Dallas said, indigenous groups and farmers and ranchers along the pipeline route have been struggling against TransCanada for years. It wasn't really until around 2011 when the fight began to build into national prominence. We helped lift up Keystone as a really iconic fight with a series of sit-ins in front of the White House back in August 2011, where 1,253 people ended up being arrested over 2 weeks of civil disobedience. It took years of organizing after that, everything from following the president around to make our voices heard, to organizing massive rallies with tens of thousands of people, to sending millions of comments into the State Department online of people all around the country, and much, much more to really push the president to make the right call on Keystone. I think one of the most amazing pieces of this saga that we're still trying to kind of absorb the many lessons of it was that we really were able to use all the different tools in our toolbox as advocates and as citizens to really make an impact on the government and pull together this incredible coalition that, as Dallas said, ranged from indigenous peoples in Alberta to climate scientists to grassroots groups to students to donors to many, many more. It's a good sign that the environmental community and so many other groups that share this concern over climate change is finding new ways of working together and beginning to push back on the fossil fuel industry as it tries to take us to the brink on climate change.
I read in some recent piece that NASA climate scientist James Hansen argued in an essay in 2011, which was very important, that fully developing the tar sands would mean game over for the climate. Was that an important and widely circulated essay that got a lot of people thinking about this in a different way?
Yeah, that was a real wake-up call for us. You know, as Dallas said, people had been concerned about the tar sands for years, but this really put it into stark relief when it came to the climate. You know, we have a limited, what scientists refer to as a carbon budget, the amount of carbon that we can continue to pump into the atmosphere before we pass critical tipping points like the 2 degrees threshold of global warming. And the tar sands would help blow past that budget alone, let alone all the other pollution that we put in from all of the other sources. And so stopping Keystone XL was critical to stopping tar sands expansion, which was critical to saving the climate and our communities. So that was a wake-up call for groups that cared so deeply about climate change and other issues to really see a key stake in this fight and understand that Keystone XL was a powerful symbol and a powerful fight in itself in terms of our larger struggle against global warming.
Dallas, I know that the president every year has dinner with representatives from every tribal region. I'm wondering how much the conversation at those dinners centered the last few years, or at least was partially comprised of conversation about Keystone XL.
Yeah, the White House hosts a tribal nation summit there, Obama himself attends. And, you know, back in 2012, we actually had some representatives, the chairmen of Rosebud Sioux Nation as well as the Oglala Sioux Nation, were able to present the president with documents calling for the rejection of KXL, as well as the Mother Earth Accord, which was this declaration from over 50 different tribal nations, farmers, ranchers, native people, advocating for the president to develop a climate test or develop a way to respond to these issues and to protect Mother Earth. And so there has been a lot of engagement from the tribal side in these consultations or these visits, and that dinner was one of those opportunities where our folks were able to voice their opinion on it.
Mm-hmm. So essentially, Jamie, I don't want to overstate this, but when this project required a presidential permit, did you really focus most of the energy? I know you had some dramatic demonstrations and arrests, as you've talked about, but did you really focus on President Obama? Did you flood him with people who talked about this? Did you give him a lot of papers on this? Because it was very much a decision that he made. You
yeah,
got him to make
really
it,
right.
But he made it.
He did. He did in the end. You know, as I said, it was a long fight, so we had many years of trying out different tactics to get the attention of the White House and push them to make the right call. You know, we learned a lot, actually, by watching other activists work with this administration. from the LGBTQ movement to the immigrant rights movement, mm-hmm. the Dreamers, other movements that learned that, you know, we all came into the Obama administration with high hopes. Many people that got arrested during Keystone XL worked on the Obama campaign to elect the president. But just like other movements, we found that some of the rhetoric that we heard on the campaign trail all the way back in 2008 wasn't necessarily translated to policy in the White House. This was a president who promised to take on global warming and said that the rise of the seas would fall during his administration. Instead, in those early years, he was opening up more federal land to fossil fuel development than any president before him, and saying that we should basically drill, baby, drill, in so many other words, as part of an all-of-the-above energy strategy. So Keystone XL emerged as a way to really hold the president to his own promises and say, this is a key test of your leadership on climate change. If you're serious about addressing this issue as you say you are, you can't promote a giant project that would unlock the tar sands and just alone would have the equivalent carbon output as something like 50 to 70 coal-fired power plants over the course of the lifetime of Keystone XL. Mm. So we did everything we could to push the president off, and we're there holding banners and signs with his own quotes on them. Saying, look, you said this, and we believe in you, but we want you to hold yourself to your own promises. Mm-hmm. So that looked like everything from sit-ins at the White House, as I mentioned, to coming back in November 2011 and encircling the White House completely with 15,000 people, to Dallas, remind me. I mean, we did so many protests, it's hard to keep track, 50,000 people in February 2013 for Ford on Climate, an amazing event called Reject and Protect that the Cowboy and Indian Alliance brought together, where we put up teepees and covered wagons on the National Mall and camped out there for a week to push the president. So, you know, it was a heck of a fight and a long struggle, but we also learned a lot and really deepened the bonds, I think, between so many of our groups and so many of our movements. It's nothing like a struggle and a common fight to bring people together. So it's been it's giving us goosebumps still to realize that we managed to pull this thing off.
I would imagine.
And again, that our work isn't done. I mean, the conversations right after Keystone between all these groups and farmers and ranchers and indigenous people was, how do we keep this going? You know, how do we keep moving? We know that Keystone was important, but it was only one fight, and we've got a lot of work to do mm-hmm. over the years ahead.
Dallas, would you comment on the importance of civil disobedience or demonstrations that Jamie just outlined, the importance of all of that to your ultimate victory?
Yeah, I want to say that, you know, first and foremost, maybe something, an answer I didn't get the chance to say is that this victory and the rejection of the northern segment of KXL, the presidential permit, really is because of everyday people. It was because of the landowners, the ranchers, the farmers, the people that depend on the land, tribal landowners, tribal people, really stood up and started to educate themselves on how this would impact them, and also just students like Jamie had mentioned, and everyday just people across the country really kind of came together, and so this victory is really because of us, and I want to just show a massive amount of gratitude and love to all the people that stood up in this fight, and I think that civil disobedience is an amazing tool to utilize to apply social and political pressure upon key targets, and in this case being, you know, the political decision makers on the pipeline, you know, folks really focused on the State Department, really focused on President Obama, and utilize civil disobedience in a very strategic and smart way to garner more public support about this and make this an important issue. And actually, I feel like there's some thanks I have to put to even the right-wing commentators who stepped it up a notch and making it an important issue for them, because it further brought this dialogue to a national scale, to where what was at one point an assumed approval of a pipeline going through the Midwest became a national topic on, you know, a future presidential debates in Las Vegas. They were talking about KXL. You know, it's the same thing when you talk about right. Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. You know, they talked about Black Lives Matter. That's a grassroots social movement that using effective messaging and civil disobedience as a means to influence national public policy and influence dialogue to a better, more sustainable future for all of us. And I just want to also state that, yeah, most folks don't know that, you know, there's other, the fight continues. I mean, that, you know, I want to show love to our people in the Gulf Coast who the Southern Leg got approved. Obama did approve that. And you know, they're still fighting for their survival and for a better life down in the sacrifice zone of the Gulf Coast. So I want to send love to them and also acknowledge that, you know, now we have an opportunity to focus on other projects that are impacting Americans today. You have the Enbridge pipeline passing through Wisconsin itself right there in your home state. You know, I think that there's a whole scheme that Enbridge has done. They want to expand capacity through Wisconsin, and we really need folks. And there is a resistance there in Wisconsin and northern Minnesota to protect the wetlands, the lakes, the forests, the land from this dirty tar sands oil. So we want to encourage our landowners and everyone else to keep the fight up and make this another victory.
Yeah, Pete, what you said is echoed by Pete from La Crosse, who sent this email. Despite the fact that Keystone XL has been rejected, we're still seeing oil moving across the country on the railways, and we've seen derailments throughout the country, including here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, as Dallas said, this is the beginning. Just, you know, this fight has been going on a long time, and Keystone should add energy to all of our movements, but the struggle continues. I mean, when we think about global warming, when you look at this issue as a whole, in some ways, things are going really well. The price of solar has dropped 90% over the last 6 years or so. Renewable energy is proving to be cheaper, more efficient, and better able to provide the energy needs of people than we ever thought possible. There's a lot of hope out there. But at the same time, the fossil fuel industry is still pushing ahead with this antiquated technology and keeping us chained down to the dirty fuels of the past. So we kind of have a dual job to do. One is to hold back the expansion of dirty energy to create the space for renewable energy to really accelerate and step forward. As individuals, unless we're solar engineers or physicists, it's difficult for us maybe as everyday citizens to help you really push that renewable energy forward. We can do what we can to help installations and things, but we're not going to maybe invent a new solar panel. What we can do as citizens is really stand up and hold back the industry from pushing these projects ahead. So that, as Dallas said, is a huge issue in the Midwest and Wisconsin, where this Enbridge pipeline company is trying to put new tar sands pipelines in. It's a huge issue all around the world, where communities are really standing up to the fossil fuel industry and saying, enough is enough. We want to keep fossil fuels in the ground. We know we have alternatives, and we can really move this forward. So Keystone is a template in a way. It shows that by picking an iconic fight, by bringing together a diverse coalition, by identifying a key decision maker, whether it's a president or a mayor, that you can target and to make your voices heard, you can actually begin to make progress.
We're going to take more phone calls in a moment. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. We're talking about the Keystone Pipeline and how activists using civil disobedience and massive amounts of education won the fight against the Keystone Pipeline. Our guests are Jamie Henn. He's the co-founder and strategy and communications director for 350.org. Dallas Goldtooth is the Keystone XL campaign organizer for the Indigenous Environmental Network. So we'll be to you in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls and Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you, Kathleen, for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't understand why Alberta doesn't build their own refinery right up near these tar sands, refine the product locally, and then distribute it out to Alberta and other provinces in the area. Why do they need to come all the way down to refineries in Texas? Additionally, Koch Industries has a refinery that handles this extra heavy crude right up in Rosemont, Minnesota, Minneapolis. Why not ship it to them? Also, the amount of heat that's required to heat the pipeline, this entire multi-thousand-mile distance, what's the equivalent number of households or energy consumed in order to heat that pipeline? This stuff is heavy, thick, almost asphalt.
Whoever wants to take it, go ahead.
Yeah, Jamie, would you be able to take up on kind of the market analysis if you have that?
Yeah, sure. Let me jump in, and then Dallas, you can maybe talk to some of the impacts too. Well, good questions. The case in Alberta is that Canada actually has never had the refinery capacity it needs to fulfill its plans to expand the tar sands, which is a good thing for the rest of us and for our climate. So it's been struggling, and the industry has been struggling for years to try and build pipelines out from this landlocked source of oil underneath the boreal forest to get it out to refineries either down in Texas, where we have some of the largest refining capacity in the world, or out to the west coast and eastern coast of Canada, where they can ship it to international markets. They've had trouble doing that thanks to resistance. All these other pipelines that have been proposed are also being blocked left and right. Again, Indigenous peoples really leading the way there. So the plans of the industry to push forward with this dirty tar sands production have been slowed down in many ways, and now we're calling on them to be frozen. In terms of the production facilities across the Midwest and elsewhere, you bring up a good point, which is that the Koch brothers have long had a big stake in tar sands production. When you look at the refineries, pipelines, and companies that are involved in this process, Koch Industries has its tentacles everywhere. That's one of the reasons why we think that it's possible that so many politicians made such a big deal about Keystone XL and jumped all over this. They may have been thinking about where their campaign contributions come from. And to your point about the pipeline itself, this was a case we and many engineers and analysts always made. This is a long pipeline. The first Keystone pipeline leaked, I think, 12 times in its first year of operation. We've seen terrible pipeline leaks like the Enbridge disaster over in Kalamazoo, Michigan, all the way down to the Mayflower spill down in Arkansas from an Exxon pipeline. These aren't safe alternatives either. Neither is rail. And so what we've been saying is, look, again, we have alternatives. Oil consumption in the U.S. is actually going down. This oil was never meant for the domestic market. It was always meant for export. And so rather than us taking all the risk in our communities of having this stuff transported through us, we think that we should stop it at the source, as Dallas said, and start moving to alternatives as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm. Dallas, we have about 30 seconds left in the show. Dallas?
Yeah, I just want to say that, you know, we have clearly proven what we're fighting against, but I think that what often gets left out of the dialogue is what we're fighting for. And, you know, what we're asking for is a moratorium, keep fossil fuels in the ground, a moratorium on future and developing fossil fuel projects, and move, have a just transition towards a sustainable renewable economy. I think that's really what's needed. We have all the technology, we have the foundation in place, and people are really demanding that. So I think that why lock ourselves into 18th century technology when we have the future ahead of us? And that's a question that we are asking ourselves on a national level. I think that's a question that folks in Wisconsin should be asking themselves when they're talking about the Alberta Clipper, which is hoping to expand and double their capacity of tar sands oil traveling through your territories.
Thank you, Dallas, very much. And Jamie, thank you. Thank you both for your time today. Jamie Henn, co-founder and strategy and communications director for 350.org, Dallas Goldtooth, Keystone XL campaign organizer for the Indigenous Environmental Network. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour and for on-air production in Milwaukee as well. News coming up.